You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Welcome to Brookings. My name is Ron Haskins. Along with Richard Reeves, I run a center here called the Center on Children and Families. Thank you all for coming, especially showing up at 8:30. We're going to have a lot more people, but most people don't show up at 8:30. We've learned that in the past at Brookings. They don't show up at 9 either. So I've been to several events celebrating the 20th anniversary of welfare reform and TANF. But this one is unique because it focuses entirely, with one exception, the afternoon panel that's going to focus on state and what states are doing. It focuses on the scholarly research. Many of you may know there was a lot of money in the bill for research, and foundations poured out a ton of money also to do research. So we really have a lot of research. I think we probably have more research on this bill, and TANF in particular, than any other legislation that I'm familiar with. So now it's time to see what we've learned from that information, addressed to what I think everyone agree are the three biggest topics: child well-being, marriage and families, and work and poverty. And so we're going to have a panel address to each one of those, and each one will be introduced by a 20-minute overview with a PowerPoint. The PowerPoints will be available after today's session, and they summarize what we have learned. The overviews are prepared by Janet Curry of Princeton, Daniel Lichter of Cornell, and Robert Moffat of Johns Hopkins, respectively. They are all top-notch academic experts. They've all reviewed this literature before, so I think we're in for a treat, and I think we'll hear something that you don't usually hear in Washington, which is, untainted by political views, what the research actually tells us. That's the intent of this meeting. Then following each of these summaries, we'll have reactions from a panel of experts who will be introduced at the appropriate time. And these panel discussions are moderated respectively by me, by Marianne Bittler of UC Davis, and by Hillary Hoynes of UC Berkeley. And then we'll also give the audience an opportunity to ask questions after each of the panels. We then open the afternoon session with a panel of state policy choices. In recent years, the states have come in for strong criticism, especially about the way they're spending TANF dollars and the way they are conducting or not their welfare-to-work programs. And we think we've selected a panel that represents all sides of this exceptionally important debate. TANF will fail without good, aggressive implementation by the states. And this panel will be moderated by Jim Ziliak, the head and founder of the Center for Poverty Research at the University of Kentucky. We conclude with a session on the implications of welfare reform by two figures who are giants in the history of TANF: Newt Gingrich, who was Speaker of the House in 1996 when TANF passed, and I can tell you from personal experience was extremely important in all the behind-the-scenes stuff going on, especially with the administration, and also Bruce Reed, who was the head of the Domestic Policy Council and President Clinton's close advisor on all things domestic, but especially welfare reform. And this session will be moderated by Diane Schatzenbach, who runs the Hamilton Project here at Brookings. The event was organized by Jim Ziliak, Hillary Hoynes, and Marianne Bittler, and I want you to know it's been a great pleasure to work with them. Mostly I just followed their orders, and everything turned out pretty well. And all of us, all of the organizers of the conference, are indebted to our funders: the Laura and John Arnold Foundation, the Institute for Research on Poverty at the University of Wisconsin, the Sanford Center on Poverty and Inequality, the University of California Davis Center for Poverty Research, and the University of Kentucky Center for Poverty Research. As background for the sessions, I'm going to take about 2 minutes. It might take longer than I thought. Oh, here we go. Okay. I'm going to give you a brief overview of the law, which will be helpful for interpreting what happens during the rest of the day. This first slide is totally forgotten. How many people knew this bill was a small number of pages in the bill were TANF? It was huge other provisions that are really important and totally forgotten, but very important. So not just TANF, there were something like 15 provisions to reduce non-marital births. No one has any idea, I don't think, of whether they had any impact, but non-marital births have been going down, and at the time TANF passed, they paused for about 3 years, and they're still paused. for Black Americans. So, and teen non-marital births have really declined greatly. What's going on over here with this panel?
We're going to move so people can see the slides.
Panelists cannot see the slides.
We're blocking the slides for the audience.
We know the slides.
They're above you. Supposed to be, anyway.
You can see.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. SSI provisions for children, extremely controversial. It definitely changed. A lot of kids lost SSI benefits because the idea was they weren't really disabled. They were, you know, they couldn't read, write, or they had some kind of modest problem, and so a lot of kids did lose SSI. That was very controversial. We completely ended the program for drug addicts and alcoholics. We used to have a guaranteed annual income if you could prove that you were an addict or an alcoholic. That's great policy. Major provisions on child support enforcement and huge impacts of those provisions. Collections increased greatly after the legislation passed, and the states aggressively implemented, and they're still doing it to this day. So we probably have the toughest child support system in the world, and it collects billions of dollars every year for single moms, mostly single moms. Welfare for non-citizens was another huge part of the bill. Clinton almost refused to sign a bill over these provisions. It basically said that if you come to America for opportunity, you cannot have welfare. Congress, including Republicans, have slowly eaten away at those provisions, and a lot of them, especially on food stamps, have been restored. But they really had a major impact. What? She's making it bigger. This does not count on my time. We created the Child Care and Development Block Grant, put all the money in one place and gave it to the states and said, do the best you can with it, with modest regulations, which many people didn't like. Introduced absence education, which to this day is very controversial. Charitable choice, which was hugely controversial at the time. I haven't heard a word about it in two decades. And the bill produced $54.2 billion in savings because a lot of people forget this, but we were in the midst of a huge deficit, attempt to end the deficit and reduce the nation's debt, the first bill that Clinton vetoed was in the context of a huge bill that had all kinds of deficit provisions in it. Now let's talk for just a second about TANF. I think we can summarize TANF, something like 80 pages of legislation, in 5 points. The first one is, and the most important, it ended the cash entitlement. It explicitly said in the statute, people are not entitled to a cash benefit. They have to deserve it. They have to do something to get the benefit they have, namely have to meet the state work requirement and a few other requirements. So that was a very big provision. Secondly, block grant funding completely changed the way that TANF, the old AFDC program worked. As you know, it was an individual entitlement, and if states added people to rolls, they got more money. If they got people off the rolls, they lost money because the federal government paid, roughly speaking, 45% on 45 cents on every dollar. And now they just get a fixed amount of money. This is still a provision. And I think it's very controversial. I think it deserves a lot more study than it has gotten. There are issues associated with block grant funding. Work requirements, of course, are the thing that people know about the best. Every state got to set their own requirements, and the states set very tough requirements, and some states have even made them tougher since their initial requirements in 1997. Probably the most important feature of the bill and what accounts for all the action that took place at the states were the sanctions. Every state also had to have a plan for sanctions, which indeed every state did. And some of the sanctions were really tough. States actually implemented them. I can remember a lot of conservatives in Washington said, states are never going to do that. They won't really implement this aggressively. They're not going to impose sanctions on single mothers, but they did, and there was a tremendous response, as many of you know. And then finally, the five-year time limit was, again, a very controversial feature of the bill. It turned out not to be very important because hardly anybody was there after 5 years. So that provision turned out not to be of very great importance. So there's an overview of the bill that we'll be discussing today. And now we will turn to our first panel. The question we pursue on this panel is, how are the kids? And Janet Curry, the Henry Putnam Professor of Economic and Public Affairs at Princeton, who also directs Princeton's Center for Health and Well-being, and in her spare time, she's also the chair of the Economics Department at Princeton. And I'll introduce the other panelists after Janet finishes her talk. Janet.
Hey, thanks. Thanks very much, Ron. I'm really delighted to be here and looking forward to what everybody has to say. And I think you're going to hear much more detailed discussions of the provisions of the actual welfare reform bill and the creation of 10F. But I'm going to try and look at the big picture. And what I'm going to argue is that in many respects, children are much better off today than they were in the 1990s before welfare reform, and especially poor children. Okay, so looking at welfare reform in a larger context, we see a lot of improvement. You can see this in mortality rates, and I'm going to spend a lot of time, relatively, in my 20 minutes, talking about that because we've been hearing so much in the media about increases in mortality inequality, and those are not happening for children. Okay? The trends are good for children, and I'll show you that. But you can also see that in other metrics. As Ron mentioned, if you look at teen pregnancy, that's been going down pretty much over the whole period. You can look at high school graduation rates, test scores, things like smoking. And so I'll show you some of those metrics as well. And I also want to emphasize that these positive trends are generally more pronounced for more disadvantaged children, and especially for African-American children. Things have actually gotten much better. And these positive trends have been almost completely ignored in public discourse. Okay, so a simple way to look at mortality differentials is to rank counties from the poorest counties to the richest counties. And then the counties have different size, and they're growing or shrinking over time. So we group those counties into bins, you can think of them, which each count for about 5% of the population. And you can do this using the census data and the vital statistics mortality data. So you can do it for every death in every county in the country. And so this figure is just showing that if you have 5% bins, you can't do this perfectly because some counties are bigger and some are smaller, but you have approximately equal size bins. Okay. So by focusing on these groups of counties, you avoid the problem that some counties are shrinking over time. Okay. So what do you do? What do you get when you do this? All right. So in this figure, I'm going to spend a little bit of time explaining it. The blue triangles are mortality rates for these groups of counties in 1990. You can see that all of these lines are sloping upwards, and along the bottom axis, we have counties arranged by poverty level. Okay, so where it says 0, those are the rich counties, and where it says 100, those are the really poor counties. Okay, so mortality rates are always higher in the poorer places. That shouldn't surprise anybody. That's true everywhere. Okay. But starting with the blue triangles, then the green and the red are the mortality rates in 2010. The reason why there's two sets of dots there is because I've calculated them two different ways. In 2010, the census allowed people to pick multiple races, and you get a different mortality rate depending on whether you include the multiple race people or not. And it actually makes a really big difference for kids, which I think is interesting. So there's more and more kids who are being counted as having multiple race. Okay? But so whether you want to use kids who have only one race or kids that have multiple race, what you see is huge declines in mortality everywhere for kids. Okay, so the blue line is everywhere much higher than the green or the red lines. Plus, if you look at how much it's declining a lot more in the 100% counties than in the 0% counties. Okay, so what does that mean? Mortality is falling more in the poorest places. So that's a decline in mortality inequality. Okay, now I'm sort of tiptoeing around the elephant in the room, or the elephant in this picture, which is how much higher the mortality rates were for blacks, for African Americans in 1990 than for whites. Okay. And that gap has closed considerably over the past 20 years. Okay, so I'm going to come back and talk about policies that I think may have contributed to that. But this is really a huge improvement for black kids over this 20-year period. Okay, so that's for the 0 to 4-year-olds. If you look at 5 to 19-year-olds, you see a similar sort of pattern, where here the thing that really jumps out at you from the figure is a very large decline in mortality rates for black males 5 to 19, right? And that decline is much bigger in the poorest places again, okay? So what do we keep reading about, right? In contrast, so this is from February of this year, this is a New York Times story where they say, disparity in lifespans of the rich and poor is growing. Okay, so why do they keep writing this? Well, all of those studies that are looking at this are looking at life expectancy for people 45 or 50 and older. Okay, and then they're extrapolating from what's going on for 45 and 50-year-olds to say, you know, oh, our children are in big trouble. Well, you know, if you actually look at the children are doing much better, as they say, than they were in 1990. And so this particular article that's talking about this research looking at 45 to 50-year-olds, I thought it was sort of particularly obnoxious that it's accompanied by a picture of a child, right? So it's really making people think that this is going on for kids, and it's not. Things are going in the other direction for kids. Inequality and mortality is falling for kids. And now what are some of the other measures we can look at? We can look at education, as I said. And so here's a figure showing the share of 24 to 29-year-olds with 4 years of high school or more. So obviously, 24 to 29-year-olds aren't kids anymore, but that shows the cumulative effect of their educational attainment, and they should be finished their high school by the time they're 24 to 29. So you have increases overall. You have increases for whites. The increases are bigger for African Americans, and they're biggest for Hispanics. So again, this pattern of bigger improvements for more disadvantaged groups. Now, one reason why this matters is because we keep hearing about how things are getting worse for high school dropouts. Okay, and in particular, white female high school dropouts have had increases in mortality. We've read about that in the newspaper also. Okay, but what's happening is there are many, many fewer white female high school dropouts than there used to be. In fact, there's 66% fewer in 2010 than in 1990. Okay, so we're talking about a different group of people, right? So 66% of the people who would have been white female high school dropouts in 1990 are no longer even in that category. Okay. And so if the people who are left are the ones who would have had the worst health in any case, that can completely explain these increases in mortality. Okay. And so here, for example, is a table from a paper in the New York Times talking about how life expectancy at birth has fallen. And you can see that that pretty much exactly mimics the change in the population share in that category. Other indicators that you can look at from other types of data sets, if you look at the Monitoring the Future data set, which is a survey that's been conducted for many years, you can look at things like the percentage of students who are reporting use of alcohol in the past by grade. So I don't want to say this is great. We're not happy that, you know, 20% of our eighth graders report using alcohol in the past year. There should be zero, but it is declining over time. Similarly, if you look at the fraction of teenagers who are smoking, that has really declined very dramatically The bottom lines here are marijuana use, and I think this may reflect legalization in some states. You do see an increase in marijuana use, but it's pretty flat. Okay. Now, the smoking, I think, is really important because smoking is really a leading cause of ill health in this country, and it can have long-term effects. So even if you stop smoking, some of the effects of smoking are reversible and some of them are not. Okay. So if you look at the fraction of people who ever smoked, among older people, where you see those increases in mortality inequality, especially for women, what this figure is showing is that people 50 plus, there's a gap between richer people and poorer people in whether they ever smoked. Okay? But for men, both of those groups are becoming less likely to have ever smoked over time. For women, you see that black line on the left is actually upward sloping. So what that means is that over time, poorer women are actually more likely to report that they ever smoked. And that's because poorer women kind of didn't get the memo when the Surgeon General's report came out in 1964. Everybody else started reducing their smoking, and poor women kept increasing their smoking. Okay, but then if we look at younger people, the ones that those monitoring the future trends apply to, we see a real gap that there are many fewer people who ever report smoking. Okay, so what that means looking forward is those people should be much healthier. Okay. Ron had mentioned the decline in teen pregnancy, which is really stunning. And again, is much greater for African Americans who started in 1990 with 116 births per 1,000, 15 to 19, so a really high rate, which is down to 41.7 by 2013. Okay, and that's pretty much a continuous decline. Okay, so in terms of policy, what are the policies that are likely to have played the greatest role? And I realize this is a conference about welfare reform and TANF, but I think you can't look at that in a vacuum. Yeah, so TANF, as Ron said, it saved $50 billion. It also represented a pivot in terms of how we're going to address poverty in this country. Okay, so the idea was, okay, we're not going to give people cash anymore. What else are we going to do instead? And so some of the things that we did were, first of all, expanding health insurance for poor pregnant women and children who are now adults and who are benefiting from having had that health insurance their whole lives. This was really a huge bipartisan policy victory for children, as far as I'm concerned, and I think it should get more attention. There are expansions of the earned income tax credit. Right? So along with the idea that we're going to make people work if we're going to give them welfare was the idea that, well, we're going to reward people for working. Right? So I remember Bill Clinton talking about how people that work shouldn't have to be in poverty. So we're going to set the earned income tax credit so that if you work full time at a minimum wage job, you're going to be raised above the poverty line. Expansions of SNAP, which used to be called food stamps, seem to have been important, and expansions of public preschool. So again, Ron mentioned the fact that states were given incentives to expand their childcare programs, and many states over the last 20 years have developed their own public preschool programs, and the number of slots in those kinds of programs are now higher than the number of slots in Head Start. So in many cases, those state programs are quite similar to Head Start in terms of the way that they're organized, but the states are now accounting for a much greater share. And so just in terms of number of dollars, you can see that the increases in Medicaid spending are kind of the elephant in the room here. And what I'm doing here is only counting Medicaid spending for children and non-disabled adults. Okay, because a really confusing thing about Medicaid, whenever you see figures about Medicaid, they're always astronomical, and that's because Medicaid is really three different programs. It's one that funds healthcare for poor women and children, one that funds health care for the disabled, and one that funds health care for elderly people in nursing homes who have spent down all their assets. Okay? And so even though the greatest number of people are the poor women and children, all the money is going to the disabled and the elderly people in nursing homes. Okay? So if you look at the amount of money that's spent on basically women and children, it's a very small share of the overall Medicaid pie. Okay, so I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about Medicaid. I only have a little bit of time. But I think it's really important for what we're seeing in terms of these positive trends. Okay, so how did this work? The states were first required, or first given the option and then required to expand Medicaid. But the states took up these requirements at different rates so that there's a lot of staggering over different states that you can use to try and identify the effect. Basically, what this figure is showing is the fraction of kids eligible for Medicaid went up first for the youngest kids and then eventually for the older kids, the 13 to 17-year-olds. And by the end of the period, half of the younger kids were eligible for Medicaid and more than 40% of the older kids were eligible for Medicaid. Okay, so half of the young kids in this country are eligible for public health insurance, and that has nothing to do with the ACA. That's expansions that happened quite a while ago. Okay. Now, these expansions only applied to children born after September 1, 1983, for reasons I never understood. And so you can use that discontinuity to try and see what is the effect. So, as I said, now these kids are adults. There are several papers following this cohort of kids that got coverage and comparing them to the cohort of kids born just before. And if you look at that, this is, for example, a paper looking at hospitalizations for chronic illnesses in black children. And so the positive part of the line here is the kids who were born after September 1, 1983 and therefore eligible for public health insurance, and the higher dots on the other side are the kids who are ineligible. So you can see in the figure the clear drop in hospitalizations, which corresponds to an improvement in health. Okay. So what I like to call the sort of bright bottom line here, in contrast to what you normally expect economists to say, which is some dismal thing, right? We're dismal scientists. Okay, so in contrast to that, I think what this shows is that even in a time of growing economic inequality, there were strong improvements in the welfare of the young, including very dramatic reductions in mortality. And I like to start with mortality because that's pretty unambiguous, right? If kids are not dying, that is definitely good. Improvements were often the greatest among the poorest and among African Americans, and so this suggests that public policy may be able to effectively buffer the health effects of economic inequality and improve the lot of poor children.
Thank you very much. All right, so now we're going to have some responses from our distinguished panelists. Jean Wongfogel, who's the Compton Foundation Centennial Professor of Social Work, Prevention of Children and Youth Problems at Columbia. How long did it take you to memorize it?
I still haven't.
And then Lonnie Berger, the Director of the Institute for Research on Poverty and a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Robert Doerr, the Morgridge Fellow in Poverty Studies at AEI. Why don't you go first, since you already have a mic and we won't waste time that way. You mind?
Janet, I'm sorry.
Lonnie, me.
So I think we're all mic.
Yeah, okay.
We're all
mic. Okay, good. Yeah, okay, so. Go ahead.
Okay, well, thank you so much for inviting me to be here, and it's a delight to follow Janet after that wonderful presentation. So with colleagues at Columbia, I've spent quite a bit of time over the past few years working on using the improved supplemental poverty measure to provide a more accurate picture of poverty trends over time. And that work clearly shows the important role played by the safety net in reducing poverty since the war on poverty and since welfare reform. Our estimates have poverty falling by about 40% since the war on poverty, with a big part of that occurring since welfare reform. So absolutely in line with Janet's presentation and her bright bottom line about big improvements for children and especially for African American children. I think it's really important that we document that success and that we celebrate it. But as we look ahead to the next 20 years, and we should also talk about what's missing and what the next step should be. So I'd like to use my 5 minutes to talk about that. I'm going to simplify things by considering families separately as employed or not employed, although, of course, we know people move back and forth, and there's a large group now that's unstably employed. For the employed, families with employed parents, we've done a lot since welfare reform, as Janet was detailing and as Ron has detailed. We've got the earned income tax credit. We have the child tax credit. We have expanded child care assistance. But the tax credits come only once a year. The child care assistance is woefully inadequate to meet the need. We haven't done anything at all at the federal level to provide paid family and medical leave, which is essential for working families with children. And there's a big set of issues around low wages, employment instability, and job scheduling for working parents. For the non-employed, the situation, of course, is much worse. We've heard about this from Ron Haskins, Becky Blank, Robert Moffat, Kathy Eden, Luke Schaefer, and a host of others. Welfare reform had some losers as well as winners. For parents who are not able to work but also aren't able to get disability or SSI, there's no source of cash income anymore. Whether we call them the disconnected, the deep poor, the $2 a day poor, they're there and their situation is dire. Unlike Canada and all the civilized countries in Europe, we don't have a basic child allowance that provides an income floor for families with children, a floor that non-employed families and many employed families need, income that comes every month to support the costs of raising a child. So that's why, along with others, I've been working on proposing a universal child allowance that would be paid monthly for every child in the United States. So that's my short list for the next steps in welfare reform: paid family and medical leave, expanded child care assistance, higher minimum wages and more family-friendly employment and hours protections, and last but not least, a universal child allowance. And I'm done under time.
Very nice. Okay.
Thank you. Yeah.
You cannot have her remaining minute.
I was going to ask that.
Okay.
Okay, so I want to make three basic points. First, I want to say, and this isn't one of my 3 points, but it's great news, right? Kids are doing better. Janet showed us a lot of evidence of that. It's not clear, you know, whether that's welfare reform or not. There was a lot of other things going on, lots of other policies, but certainly kids haven't been hurt in the last 20 years despite growing inequality, and I think that that's really important. Jane's point about the deep poor, disconnected poor, so we can quibble about how much they've increased or how to calculate it. Regardless, there's a substantial number of families that are disconnected, that have limited access to cash. The best evidence suggests that these aren't families that are completely long-term unemployed, but also face periods of unemployment, unstable employment, unstable hours. They're also families that are disproportionately struggling with psychosocial issues. And I think we need to have somewhat of a larger conversation about who's ready to work, who can participate in the work-based safety net, who might do better with jobs of last resort or some kind of publicly provided jobs versus being able to work in the private market, sort of what's reasonable to expect. And, you know, cash is important. And I think we have a really growing body of evidence that suggests that money matters. Most of it happens to be from random variation in EITC expansion, so it's really disproportionately affecting workers. But around health, well-being, around even reductions in child maltreatment, money matters, and I think that the evidence is growing there. Second point I want to make is, so we can think about, you know, huge reductions in AFDC, now TANF participation, in that sort of cash welfare. Social welfare spending on low-income populations has increased generally throughout that period. I'm guessing Robert Moffat will talk about that today. And so we've actually invested quite a lot, particularly in SNAP, EITC, disability and public health insurance. I think that there's two ways to think about this. So one of the things that we want to think about is that jobs probably aren't enough low-wage jobs. And so do we want to think about these programs as being long-term supports and potentially intergenerational supports? So Jim Zeliak's done work looking at, you know, welfare reforms associated with a decrease in intergenerational transmission of TANF or AFDC, but not food stamps, right? And part of it is that the jobs that people are getting aren't enough to live above poverty or to live above the qualifications of these programs. And somewhat connected to that, I think we need to rethink a little bit about these policies in a context of much more complex and fluid families. And so how do we think about benefits when people are spending time in multiple and different households? Which leads me to my third point, which is around non-custodial parents. So welfare reform did a ton around establishing paternity, around more stringent child support enforcement, and around really setting the expectations for non-custodial parents. We did much less to assist those parents in meeting those expectations. So while child support enforcement has increased, it is still relatively low. At the same time, for single-parent families that receive it, it's a large proportion of their income. I think that the current way we do services to custodial parents versus non-custodial parents has problems in terms of equity, has problems in terms of reciprocity, and has problems in terms of the potential for child support and non-custodial parent support to help child well-being and reduce poverty. And essentially, non-custodial parents are treated as non-parents, right? So they're adults without dependents. Essentially, they have very few services to assist them in getting jobs. For the most part, whether we like TANF or not, in theory, it pays women a benefit or custodial parents a benefit while they're going through job programs. Depending on the state, you get a community service job. There's a process of moving toward independence. For the most part, we expect the non-custodial parents to start paying child support, to have very little concrete supports and, the prospects of a job, particularly if you have a criminal justice history at the end of that road. And even, lots of proposals and recent policies around non-custodial parent EITC, they generally are low benefits and high eligibility criteria. So you have to be current on child support for a year. So there's actually no reason to do that, right? So if you're working on the books, your child support wages get withheld. If you get an EITC, the money can be withheld and transferred to the child. Why wait a whole year? Why not do it on every dollar the fathers are making or the non-custodial parents and support them more? Thanks.
Robert Doerr.
Okay, so I want to begin by saying that poor children in America today face many obstacles, and as a result, their ability to rise and thrive economically is not as great as we all want. This means that no discussion of the 1996 Act can really be a great celebration. Even if the Act has succeeded in its most important goal, and I think it has, low-income children, particularly those with never married households, still face challenges we should continue to focus on, even if we think welfare reform moved them and our country in the right direction. So I come to praise the Welfare Reform Act, but not to declare victory in the fight against poverty in America. Point number two, no anti-poverty program acts alone in children's lives. And the TANF program is now only a small part of our overall safety net. And while I believe work requirements, time limits, and fixed funding have all contributed to higher labor force participation for single mothers and reduced poverty for children, I also know that the economy and other programs have also played a role. Academics can try to disentangle and isolate the effect of TANF, but it really is almost impossible to do. So many other forces are at work, and they all interact together to aid a family. It is the combination of TANF work requirements, greater child support collection, more EITC, and more public health insurance, and more SNAP, and more earnings, which have helped poor families become better off than they were in 1996. Third point, we need to be clear about what TANF's goal is. TANF's goal, or at least the goal I sought for the welfare agency in New York City, was to help very poor families get to work and reach the first rung on the economic ladder. Other aspects of American life and a recipient's own initiative can help people move fully into the middle class. Imposing on TANF the goal of achieving middle class incomes is unreasonable and unworkable. Fourth, the focus and emphasis on work first and personal responsibility for New York was a huge change. No state or city was as infected by the rights-based welfare of pre-1996, and I think no state benefited as much from the responsibility focus of welfare reform. The fact that New York City ended the period with the lowest child poverty rate among our nation's largest cities shows the extent to which we have benefited more than others. My AEI colleague, Angela Rashidi, will shortly come out with a paper that looks at the Columbia anchored poverty supplemental measure and shows that in the period between 2005 and 2014, poverty declined by 5 percentage points in New York City. Finally, when you think of child well-being, it is all-encompassing. And in New York City, in food security, in child welfare, in school readiness, in school performance, in teen pregnancy, there is a lot of evidence that child well-being got better in the years after 1996. Only in homeless housing, where the city's very tight housing market, partially caused by a growing population, led to a big increase in family homelessness, was there a notable move backwards. Now, TANF cannot take the credit for all the advances, nor should it take the blame for the increase in the shelter census. But certainly our broader approach to require work and reward work improved the lives of many New Yorkers. So where do we go from here? No public policy is perfect, and TANF is no exception. I wish the federal block grant came with greater requirements that more of the money be spent on TANF-eligible families. And I wish the work participation rate was not as easily manipulated by the states. But I believe other safety net programs have bigger problems and offer greater potential for improvement and should be given priority by Congress. Most of all, we need to expand work programs for poor men and especially poor non-custodial parents. Child care funding should be increased, and the program needs to do more to help families choose quality providers. I would extend the child support enforcement cooperation requirement to SNAP single-parent families. I would expand nurse-family partnership programs. I would do more to help SNAP recipients get to work. I would fix the error rate in the EITC so that we can then increase it for childless adults. And I think we can be way more effective in combating abuse in provider fraud in Medicaid. And finally, I would require the states to devote special case management attention to single-parent families on SNAP who report no earnings and are not on TANF. Those are the disconnected moms. We know where they are. They're on the SNAP program. We ought to be looking into what's happening. Now, after we all do that, we can fix the problems with TANF.
Good. Thank you very much. The great panel. Wonderful comments. I'd like to look back for 1 second just to remind people, and I'm trying not to reflect it, 2 years of this debate and how bitter it was, and I mean, it was really a very, very nasty debate. And one of the things that Democrats claimed with great regularity was that children were going to die, they were going to starve. Daniel Patrick Moynihan said on the floor of the Senate that they'd send carts around in the morning and winter to pick up the frozen little babies. So it was really a bitter debate. I think this panel shows two things. One, that kids are not worse off. They're better off. It's not necessarily tied to TANF. Some part of it may be tied to TANF. But secondly, that we still are not doing a great job by our kids. They still have a lot of needs. We could improve our policies greatly, especially if we could make more progress on the agenda of more people working and then supplementing their income, which is the single best thing we've done to reduce poverty. Does anybody disagree with that on the panel?
I would only say one thing in the defense of Daniel Patrick Moynihan and John Lewis is I'm not so sure they knew that there was going to be this big expansion in public health insurance, for instance. A lot of other things, I think Janet shows that, played a role in preventing the downside effects of the firm, stringent TANF work requirement, which I believe in very strongly. But those other things cushioned the effect.
So your correction would be, oh, go ahead.
And I think all of us underestimated what the employment rates of single mothers would be. I mean, we had plausible estimates based on previous experiments, previous evidence, and we all of us underestimated how much single parents could increase their work effort. And I don't think any of us foresaw the booming economy that was going to be happening in the late 1990s. So these women were pushed off of welfare into an economy that really needed them and wanted them. And a lot of them went into the nursing assistant sector, where maybe they were benefiting at the other side of the Medicaid expansions because maybe there was more demand for nursing assistants. Because that was the number one job. We sort of forget. Now we think about all these single moms working in the retail sector in these very unstable, very variable hours jobs. But in the era 20 years ago, they were going into nursing assistant jobs, home care attendants. There was a big boom in demand for that. We were just sort of coming to terms with the elderly population. So these are forces that I think none of us foresaw.
And the EITC was kind of a sleeper program, right? In the sense the expansion of the EITC did start at the same time, but nobody really understood how it would grow and what an impact it would have. So I think some estimates are that the EITC had more to do with luring single women into the workforce than TANF had to do with throwing them off, right? So you were actually doing better with carrots than with sticks.
No, that's absolutely right. And we know from work on the EITC that the way single moms used the money, they knew it was coming, and they used it to pay for their clothing and their footwear so they could go to work, for work expenses, for transportation, and to pay back bills. So EITC provides a cushion where you can let your bills run up for a few months so you know it's coming. So I think once the word got out that this was, you know, a benefit you could count on, people adjusted to it.
I should also say that the, you know, the transformation of the welfare offices in New York City from income maintenance offices to job centers sent a very strong message that was very immediate in poor families' lives. And so it's a push and a pull, and I think they're both important.
I want to come back to that, but first, I think we all should agree, and let's see if we do, that there were really three factors that account for the initial success of welfare reform, and it's continued to success. The poverty rates are still lower, the work rates among mothers are still higher, despite the recessions and so forth, and that is the economy was great, the EITC is a huge factor, welfare reform is a big factor, but something must be said about the mother's motivation. They said in interviews all along they wanted to work, and when given a chance and shown that it could be financially beneficial, they did it. So it's a complex set of factors, including other policies. It wasn't just TANF. My point in posing that first question was both sides were wrong. We still have problems with kids. Everything wasn't shining and wonderful, but it's better. And part of it is work, but part of it is these other policies as well. Mm-hmm. We agree on that?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, let's get a little further into this. One of the things that people didn't notice much about welfare reform was that it culminated in the kind of policies we don't do in Washington anymore. Policies, a set of, I would say, eight or ten bills directed primarily by Waxman to expand Medicaid for children, step by step by step by step. Mm-hmm. And an important part of that was completely severing the link between welfare and Medicaid. In the old days, get this, in the old days, you could not get Medicaid, even for children, unless you were either on SSI or AFTC. That, the final step in that was severed by welfare reform, and then the next year we passed the state child health insurance program. So now I think we can say something very close to virtually every kid in the country under 150 to 200% of poverty is covered by Medicaid. This suggests, does it not, that we should, a big focus of our policy should be that in every state, kids up to some 150% or 200% of poverty should have Medicaid coverage and will continue to get the kind of results that you showed on mortality and other measures?
Yeah, I think this is huge in the sense, you know, there is a real risk of backsliding on that, and people just don't know about these success stories. So I don't want to sound like Pollyanna. It's not like I think everything is wonderful now. But if you don't recognize the progress that has been made, then people will not value the programs that are responsible for the progress. So Medicaid now is covering 40% of the births in this country. And every kid that's paid for under the Medicaid program, then they're covered for their first year of life. And then, you know, a large share of those kids go on to continue to have Medicaid coverage. And it's one of the things where the statistics aren't that great, because since providers know that they can get reimbursed by the Medicaid program, people don't necessarily always have a valid card. Right? But if they go to the hospital, they can still get services because the hospital knows that it's going to be paid for by the Medicaid program. Okay, so there's also been a shift in the way that providers care for low-income people because they don't have to worry about eating the cost. Okay, and I think this has just been a sea change in the way that kids are treated.
Even before the Affordable Care Act, the uninsured rate in New York City for children was less than 6%. So what Janet said about poor children having this enormous expansion of health insurance coverage well before that, during the welfare reform transition period, was extremely important. But it also does point up the enormous imbalance in investment. I mean, in New York City, it's $25 billion a year for the Medicaid program and 3 for food stamps and less than 1 for TANF. So Medicaid, in addition to covering a lot of kids, soaks up a lot of money.
Yeah, although, like I said, you really have to be careful. I mean, in a way, the biggest thing that you could do for the Medicaid program for women and children would be to peel it off and mm-hmm. call it something else.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of the money is not going to the kids. And so people keep looking at those numbers and they say, you know, oh my God, the Medicaid rolls are going through the roof. We've got to do something about this. And it must be because all these children are joining the rolls. Well, that's not what's driving it. What's driving it is the, you know, ballooning costs for disabled and elderly people, right? So I'm not saying you should throw them off the rolls either, but that's where the cost is growing.
Yeah. So I think that the Medicaid expansion has been huge. It's been really helpful for children. And I think that one of the things that we don't think about as much is that it also provides often a means of getting services that we don't think of as traditional healthcare. So for families involved with the child protective services system, interventions around behaviors and around things like that. But it's worth considering also that, you know, huge expansion in participation, access to care is still somewhat varied depending on where you live. So we don't want to forget
by state,
that.
You mean
by
or
state
county
and by
or
county and by rural, you know, those kinds of things.
And the quality.
And the quality of care, right. And so I think we want to keep that in mind. And then, you know, again, like, I don't think so. When we think about how families are doing, you know, putting a huge value on the transfer in terms of health care, there's lots of other things that families need. And I worry a little bit about saying, oh, we're investing in all this money in poor families, and the poverty rates come down so much because we're weighting healthcare so, you know, so heavily.
Yeah. Okay. Now let's deal with a probably the broadest issue of all. Several states have made about financing the amount of money available to kids, and we increased a lot of spending on programs. The data for spending on children from all federal sources clearly shows that for at least 3 years it has declined as a percentage of federal spending, and that this has taken place while Social Security and Medicaid continue to be totally out of control. And just reflect on this for a minute. Medicare. They don't have a budget. Congress never votes to spend a penny on Social Security and Medicare. They're just on automatic. They just keep going. And meanwhile, spending on kids is declining, and it will. I don't see any other way for it not to decline. So what do we say about this? What's our response if we're concerned about the kids and we're making this progress? I think it's threatened over the next decade or so because of this pattern of federal spending.
But I think actually a really big picture issue with that is that if people don't know that these programs have been successful and that kids are doing better, then when push comes to shove in the budget, they say, well, why should we be spending billions of dollars on these programs if they don't do anything, right? So how often have you heard that? That's why it's so important to talk about the successes as well as the failures and what needs to be improved and so on and so forth. Because if you don't, then you have no case to make when these difficult budget choices have to be made.
So assume now we're at sort of an optimal moment, because there's a tension now on these policies, but 20th anniversary of welfare reform. We've seen there's these big reductions in mortality, inequality, big improvements in health, big improvements in child poverty we've documented since the war on poverty. Hey, these programs actually work pretty well. So how much should we be spending to tackle poverty? So there was a wonderful Brookings volume a few years back called 1% for the Kids. And I'm looking at Belle Sawhill because that was her volume. And David Leonhardt just the other day in the New York Times wrote a piece again calling for us to spend 1% for the kids. So if we're really serious about tackling child poverty, we've done a great job. We're almost halfway there in terms of tackling child poverty. But to get the other half of the way there, we have to spend more. And so David goes through the sort of thought exercise of what would we do if we were going to spend, you know, if we were going to spend 1% for the kids. So I think all the money we're spending now, we've been talking about the EITC and SNAP, it's about half of 1% of our GDP. So that's what we're spending now. And if we doubled that, we could obviously do quite a bit more. So this seems like exactly the right moment to be having that conversation.
Robert.
But the key ingredient is not only what we would spend it on and how we would increase it, it needs to be where we would find the pay for. And I think, Ron, you introduced the topic by indicating that there's a generational imbalance. And I think it's a serious issue. And I think that folks in Washington who care about the long-term fiscal situation are also caring about investing more in kids, but they aren't going to be comfortable doing it until we come forward with real savings in these other programs.
Yeah, families, kids out of spending on the elderly, especially the rich elderly. What, that seems like a fairly reasonable idea, but try and seeing I think that Democrats up on the Hill, it's not going to work too well. Okay, one last issue I want to deal with. All this spending, guaranteed income, children's allowance, all that, okay. But the other side of this is, what about more work? What could our agenda be that would increase work by low income and including fathers? We clearly have failed. I was so happy that you pointed that out. And you should mention that there are, I think, 10 or 8 random assignment, big studies going on in the country now that child support agencies are doing to try to work with the fathers and get them employment. Without employment, they're not going to be able to pay their child support, and they're going to live a miserable life. Half of black men between 18 and 24, I think it is, do not work. You can't build a community like that. So how can we help this group work more?
Well, one of the deficiencies of the studies, as I understand it, is that none of them are mandatory programs. So that's an issue. And I think that Lonnie's right. The connection to non-custodial parents is often through the child support enforcement program, and it's imbalanced. There should be more attention to how we get them into employment that is tied to their obligation. So I think that is a big one. I think that would be better done through Congress as opposed to through a reg, and with ample funding, which it is not in the current proposal. So I have always felt that there is an opportunity there to reach the very people we're talking about. And the other is the reentry world, guys coming home from prison. I think there's a great opportunity there to help guys get into work, and we ought to be focusing on that.
So I can comment on so Ron mentioned this 8-state randomized evaluation. So it's called the Non-Custodial Parent Child Support Employment and Parenting Demonstration Project.
It sounds like Jane's title.
Yeah. the Institute for Research on Poverty and Mathematica are jointly evaluating it. We don't have results yet, but essentially the idea is for non-custodial parents that mostly have child support arrears or problems, give them a case management service that really helps to better set realistic child support orders, work around arrears reduction in some circumstances. There's a mandatory, if you participate in the program, employment, participation, training, et cetera. And then there's a fatherhood piece to it. So like I said, we don't have results. I think that one potential drawback is, so a lot of these guys have criminal records, criminal backgrounds, are coming out of jail. So you may get some arrears forgiveness during the training period time, but you're not getting any money coming in. And so you're still being told to sit in a training program when you may need to be out hustling for rent because you're staying with your brother-in-law or your sister who needs some money for rent and you just got out of it. And I think that, you know, we need to sort of support the guys during the time that they're going through training. We'll see. Hopefully there will be jobs at the end of the road. But I think that's a great place for private sector partnerships, or really getting local employers or big corporations on board to give child jobs. Maybe they need to be subsidized, but making sure that we actually have some jobs at the end of the training.
Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to come back to the point that you were making earlier about the moms' motivation and that a lot of these moms want to be working. I commented yesterday on a great new paper by Danny Schneider and Kristen Harknett about workers who are working unstable and variable hours. And not only were they concerned about the lack of advance notice and their hours changing week to week, but a consistent theme for these low-wage workers was that they're not getting enough hours. They would like to work more hours. They're not getting enough hours from their employer because the employers are keeping this pool of workers who are all on short hours contracts. So I think we have to look at the employer side as well. I guess on a more positive note, the trends that we've been talking about in terms of increased educational attainment and kids improving their skill levels, eventually that's going to feed through and we're going to have higher skilled workers who are going to be more in demand on the part of employers. There is a role for education and training here.
So, Ron, I feel like we would be remiss if we didn't say anything about disability.
because a lot of these people who want to work may have some kind of disability, and the way the system is set up, it's so difficult to get onto disability, and then if you go to work, then they'll take it away, and you might never get back.
Plus your Medicaid.
Right, plus your Medicaid. So you, by going to work, you risk losing your stability and your health insurance. And that's just not a sensible system. I think there's many people who could work at least part of the time. Maybe they can work this month, but they can't work next month. And just trying to have some kind of system that would support people to work rather than penalizing them when they try is really important.
Okay, let's go to the audience. A microphone will come around, and you tell us your name and where you are, and then ask a question. Keep in mind, we're definitely going to have a lot of questions. We'll be able to get fewer questions in if anybody gives a speech. Please don't do that. Ask a question. Start with a lady right behind you.
Thank you very much. I'm June O'Connell. It is not cheap to be poor, and it is not cheap to be on welfare. So I wonder, in the terms of either this panel or the day, if someone would address sort of like the shopping cart. If I were a on welfare person in West Baltimore, how much it would cost me to get baby aspirin, how much it would cost me to get milk, how far I'm not talking about food deserts, I'm talking about the cost. Because it seems to me that a component that's often missing is that it is expensive to be poor. You don't get to go to Costco and get toilet paper in bulk. So I wonder how you would fit that sort of question of the expense of being poor for basic items.
Yeah, I think, I mean, in developing the supplemental poverty measure, the Census Bureau has put a lot of work into developing thresholds, you know, sort of living standards. And so they have a price for a basic bundle of goods, plus a little bit more for things like shampoo and toothpaste and baby aspirin, plus, you know, your food, shelter, clothing, utilities, plus a little bit more. And it's not cheap. I think it's about $500 a month per child is what we're talking about. And there's no state that would have welfare benefits anywhere close to that.
That if your daughter lives in North Baltimore, she goes to a Costco to shop.
Right.
For her kids, and she buys 10 items. But if she lived in West Baltimore, next door to Freddie Gray, she would go to a 7-Eleven or an inner city CVS, and she
okay,
would
so
buy
what,
10
what's
items.
The what's the solution so, to that?
Well, actually, I don't know that there's very much good data on that. So I have seen some studies trying to look at that, mostly in the context of food deserts, because there's been so much publicity on that. And they don't actually find that much evidence of the food deserts or that the difference in cost is that much. So this is something that people are always talking about. And, you know, maybe it's a big problem, but we don't have data documenting that it's a big problem. And so that's why you find the panel not really being able to give you it. Like, we don't actually know that it's a thing, so we don't know what to do about it.
Another question. Right here on this.
I think this is a segue from the first question, and I didn't hear anybody.
Tell us your name, will you?
Larry Checo, Accountability Central. Housing never came up here, and I think it's part of what this lady is talking about as well. Our housing policies over the last 30, 40, 50 years since the Great Society Movement has created islands of poverty, islands where these people are actually isolated from all opportunity, not only food, but jobs and health care and all the rest of it. So I think housing has to be a part of this, and I would wonder if somebody could address that.
Anybody want to make comment on that?
I can talk about that a little bit. I mean, one of the things that's happened is that federal policy has really gone away from projects or project-based assistance to voucher-based assistance. Right? So almost all the new spending is on Section 8. Vouchers and other similar programs, local governments are trying to encourage mixed income developments through various kinds of subsidies to developers. So that's certainly the direction of the policy now. Whether it's been successful or not, I know there's lots of trouble with Section 8, trying to find landlords who accept Section 8. Often what landlords will tell you is that the requirements are very onerous. They don't like having to do a whole bunch of things to their units in order to rent them when they can rent them to somebody else without a voucher, without doing all of those things. And so I guess, I mean, sticking with the carrots versus sticks insights, maybe making it easier for landlords to comply or assisting them to comply, giving landlords low-income loans to bring their units up to Section 8 standards, or maybe those kinds of things would be effective. But as far as I know, they haven't been tried.
Robert.
I mean,
so in New York City, we have large public housing complexes, NYCHA housing, and one of the benefits of the resurgence of the city has been that neighborhoods that once were very much dominated by public housing and were, as you say, isolated neighborhoods have become much more economically integrated. And the city did a study that looked at the effect of that increased integration of different economic levels into the community and found that in NYCHA areas, NYCHA housing complexes, where that happened, there were good outcomes for the residents. And where that kind of economic integration didn't happen, there weren't so much. So, you know, the Raj Chetty report about moving to opportunity showed that if you move people to places where there's more economic diversity, that can be good for poor families. But it can also be good for poor families if we reinvigorate poor neighborhoods by bringing a greater economic diversity into them. So I think we should work on both. And I think the second is a lot easier.
I just wanted to add, Ron mentioned earlier the difference between entitlement programs and limited funding programs. So, you know, Social Security and Medicare are entitlement programs. If you meet the eligibility, you get the benefit. It's not the case with housing. So we really have a lottery. And so a minority of eligible families get any kind of housing assistance. And so we haven't dealt with that fundamental problem with the housing subsidy system. Unlike other countries that have, you know, have in open-ended entitlement, if you're low income, you get help with your housing costs. And I know, Ron, you've talked about what would happen if you took the existing housing benefit and spread it more equally among the eligible population rather than having some huge winners and some huge losers.
It's also hard to get.
Yes. Yes.
All the way in the back?
Hi, my name is Karen Nelson. I'm in commercial real estate, and I work with a lot of affordable housing developers, but I also work with a lot of associations and nonprofits who work with the underserved community, single mothers, the whole gamut. It seems to me, in talking with the recipients of these benefits, that the one thing no one has ever said to them from the first days of their education is, all work is valuable. You do not need to go to college. There are lots of jobs out there where employers would be delighted to have you. Here's what those jobs are. We're desperate for people who know how to
fix... Need to get to a question quickly.
Yeah, who know how to fix Metro. We can't find it. We can't find qualified construction people.
Not an insignificant.
So is there a way in our education system to stress all kinds of work from the very earliest stages of education?
Well, I actually think this is an important point in the way in which the federal government and state governments implement these programs. I believe that a message from Mayor Bloomberg, for instance, which was his total message, was that every job is a good job, helps encourage people to move into the workplace and then leverage the low wages with the work supports that make their material well-being much better off than the wage alone would allow. If, on the other hand, you do have the rhetoric of entry-level jobs or minimum wage jobs are bad jobs, then you're going to have less likely for people to take those jobs and take advantage of this system that Ron Haskins and others built, along with Congress and the White House. So I think it's very important that we celebrate the benefits of work in not only in the wages provided, but in the subsidies that make those wages go further, and in the dignity and structure that that brings to people's lives. And when the rhetoric is different, when the only rhetoric you hear from politicians is, we need a $15 minimum wage, and we can't allow employers into our area that don't pay or provide, then all of a sudden, all jobs aren't viewed as a positive step forward for low-income Americans.
So, you know, I would agree that the messaging is important about the value of all work. But I think welfare reform actually showed that for a lot of the low-income women, they are willing to take these jobs, and they do want to work, and they did move into these jobs. So I get that there's variation, but on average, you know, I think the message played out, and you know, people took the low-wage jobs.
But one more thing. The men don't get the benefits. Because they don't have children in the household, they take the same job, and they can't leverage the food stamp benefits and even Medicaid or EITC.
They
and
can leverage
that makes it harder.
Stamps.
Yeah, but it's not the same as you have two kids in the household.
Right down the aisle here.
Hi, Russ Sykes, APHSA. I have so many questions to ask, but I'm going to ask this one very simply. After 20 years, when are we going to learn that measuring the success of TANF through a performance measure that talks about bean counting instead of talking about employment is really not going to work, particularly with the advent of WIOA and the connection of SNAP ENT and so forth? When are we going to learn that we need to start talking about employment outcomes, placement, retention, other things? Because going forward, there's such a gulf between TANF and WIOA as far as their performance metrics that it's going to be impossible.
Have a specific proposal, Russ?
How are we going to make the TANF-WIOA partnership work if the performance measures are so totally out of whack with each other? Mm-hmm.
And so your proposal is that TANF should change and adopt those performance
measures? I think over time there needs to be a transition to more outcome-based measures for TANF rather than process measures.
Yeah.
Amen.
Yeah. I think almost everybody does research agrees with this, and I think the public would agree with it too, but it's very difficult to get policymakers, and maybe states, I'm not sure. We'll have a state panel this afternoon. Let's be sure that question is put to the state panel, because there are reasons that we don't do this. I'm not exactly sure what they are. Another question. I think we have one more. All the way in the back on the aisle.
Hi, my name is Graham Peterson. I'm with the Niskanen Center. This goes to Mr. Berger. You're talking about prisoner reentry programs. I had the chance to work with a reentry program in Chicago back in the day, and these gentlemen were pretty explicit that they're asking us. We were working with a microlender who was going to hand out $5,000-$10,000 loans if they had business plans that were viable. And the question that came up over and over again was, am I going to lose my benefits if I take this check or whatever? So to Ms. Curry, you mentioned that people were losing benefits. What are the challenges to putting these people in a position where if they do re-enter or especially start some kind of entrepreneurial venture where there's opportunity for growth, what are the challenges to getting it such that they can keep their benefits when they start making a nominal income?
Lonnie?
So I think that this idea of cliffs and of losing benefits as you start making more or you know, if they worry about it with these loans is a real problem. Janet brought it up around families with kids. I actually think that the problem for the men, so that may apply to if they're living in a household, and they're on a SNAP benefit with some kids or a partner or whatever. Most of the men, if they're single adults, aren't really getting much in benefits to begin with, right? So if they don't live with a kid, they're not generally drawing down the EITC. They can qualify for SNAP, right? They're going to get, if they're a single childless adult without not part of a food unit, it's going to be harder to qualify. It's going to be a small benefit, et cetera. So while I think that is a big problem for the men coming out of prison, I think the bigger problem is the access to benefits to begin with and access to supports while they're working or to help them get into work.
So in my system of values, there's nothing more important than questions. But from the perspective of the audience, they also value breaks. We're on break. We'll start again at 10 o'clock sharp. If you're here or not, we're starting. Join me in thanking the panel.